Now, you're playing Swallow Hill, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'll bet you've been to Swallow Hill a few times.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have a knitting circle before that show. A local knit shop is going to show up, and we're going to have knitters. Because in Denver, the knit shop owner contacted me at my website and asked me if I was still doing knitting circles. I said, I sure will if you'll be there. So she's going to co-host it with me.
Well, I know knitting circles are a pretty popular thing around here, so I will get the word out.
Yeah, we'll tell people come an hour early and bring your knitting. And you know what? Yes. I do it intermission. We try to be full-service performers. So we'll knit before the show. But during intermission, I teach people how to fold napkins in fancy ways, like Downton Abbey, but I also learn some new folds for Christmas.
Well,
so
Chris,
if we're going to have a nice Christmas party, they can come and up their skills of napkin folding.
Christine Lavin, you still have a sense of humor, don't you?
This isn't funny. I take this very seriously.
Rock and roll, baby.
No, I don't know why, but people love napkin folding. And it's I've also learned that it sort of eats into my merch sales because people are way too interested in napkins. In fact, I think people now are coming to the show for the napkin folding and staying for the concert, but really they're there for the napkin folding.
So is that like folding origami? No.
It's somewhat like that, but it's, you know, they're cloth napkins, and they're 20 by 20 inches, and there's really a lot you can do.
Like
and
what?
It's very,
tell me.
It's very calming. It's like knitting. There's something about it that's very calming, and it's nice because, you know, once you see a fancy napkin, it means a good dinner's coming.
Well, there's that, and I love the idea of knitting. I mean, I still have a sweater that my grandmother knitted for me. Now, I can't fit in it anymore, but I still have it.
Oh, but that's so nice. You know, when I lived in New York, I'm not living there now. I'm living upstate helping out with the care of my mom, who's 97. But I lived in a fancy building with a doorman and an elevator operator. And the elevator operator told me, he was from Albania, that his mother knitted all their clothes. And when they outgrew them, she unraveled them and knit them again in bigger sizes.
Wow.
Isn't that something? And you want to know what he always wanted? He always wanted store-bought clothes. He always thought his hand-knitted stuff was not as nice. And, of course, now as an older man, he realizes how lucky he was. He had custom-made clothing.
Yes.
His mother would make him one size and then unravel and make it a bigger size when he grew.
Well,
sweet.
Did your mother knit for you, Christine?
No. My mom's a crocheter, but she has 9 children. And so she was just lucky to, you know, keep us all, you know, clean and dressed. That was about as much as she could do for 9 kids.
So you had 8 siblings?
Yes.
Wow. Huh. Do you think that affected
you?
I only had 1 sibling. I have 1 sibling. But do you think that might have put you on the path that you're on, maybe?
Well, one thing about coming from a big family, people always say, what's it like? Well, you don't have anything to compare it to. It's your own experience. But over the years as a performer, I'm always teaming up with other musicians. I love bringing other people on stage. And I think it's because I'm comfortable being in a group, and I'm not that comfortable being alone on stage.
Well, I could see one upside of a big family is there's certainly a lot to observe and a lot to take in, a lot of content.
Yeah, the thing is, though, it's also there's a lot of opinions and a lot of squabbling and a lot of quarreling, and some of it gets better with age, and some of it grows more intense with age. So, but I think for older parents, if you've had a big family, there's a good chance that you'll be taken well care of in your old age because you've had enough children to make sure you had enough good ones.
Well, now, did the music bug hit you? Bite you as a child, or did that come later?
You know what? I actually started on the piano when I was 7 years old, but I had a terrible, crazy teacher who had a long pencil who would crack my knuckles whenever I would play the wrong note.
Oh.
And it was horrible. I would walk home crying after every lesson. My knuckles would be red and sore. And eventually my mom let me quit lessons after 2 years because one of the teachers at the school where we live, we grew up at a military school, her name was Mrs. Bejan. She was in her 60s, and she started taking piano lessons from the same teacher. And when she cracked her knuckles, Mrs. Bejan stood up, grabbed the pencil, broke it in two, threw it in the teacher's face, walked out, and that was the end of her piano lesson. And because we had party lines back then, the word spread like wildfire all around town that Mrs. Bejan destroyed the demon pencil. And so all the parents started to believe the children about how they were getting hit by this teacher. So it was about 5 years later that I started playing guitar because I watched lessons on public TV. And it didn't take me long to figure out that if I played along with the lady on the TV, if I played it wrong, she couldn't hit me through the TV set.
Did you write a song about that?
Well, you know what? Actually, I did. Because I'm friends with Julie Gold, who wrote the song From a Distance, the Bette Midler song. And, you know, from a distance, the world looks blue and green. And so she has always believed that that is a magic piano that she wrote that song on. So over the past 2 years, she's asked her friend to sit at her magic piano for an hour at a time and see if they can get a song out of it. And I kept turning her down because of my history with piano that she didn't know. I didn't want to stir up those horrible feelings of getting whacked by that demon pencil. But finally, she wore me down, and I sat at the piano, and I wrote a song about the horrible piano teacher When I think about it, I could really thank her now, because if it wasn't for her whacking me in the knuckles with a pencil at a piano, I might not have taken up guitar.
So that was the key moment, taking up the guitar.
Yeah, and I met my guitar teacher 26 years later when she came to a show in San Francisco that I was performing, and they put my picture in the paper and said I learned how to play guitar when I was 12 watching lessons on public TV. And she looked at the picture, estimated my age, figured out what year that was, and came to the show with her business card. And on the back she wrote, "Did I teach you how to play guitar?" And I was like, "Oh my God, my guitar teacher's in the audience." And it was so funny. It was a Poor Bitch and Babe show. So there was Sally Fingerette, Megan McDonough, and Patty Larkin all on stage with me, who are all much more accomplished musicians than I am. And during intermission, I got to meet Laura Weber. That's the name of the guitar teacher from PBS. And she said, "You make up for all my live students who never practiced. And the best part is, you're the best guitarist on stage." And the truth is, I was the least of the guitarist, but she was so proud. She thought I was the best.
Four Bitch and Babes. Wow, that there's a blast from the past.
They're still out there.
Are you still do? That was my question. You still tour as Four Bitch and Babes, huh?
No, I don't. I left the group in 1997 because it started not to be fun for me. And
okay.
You know, and I knew that somebody else could take my place and it would bring the fun back. And so there's been a, you know, rotating crop of babes who've been in the show. I mean, Janice Ian was a babe. Mary Travers, the late, great Mary Travers, Peter, Paul, and Mary, she was a babe. Even Dave Van Ronk was a babe. but that was a very short stint.
Well, I read somewhere that it was Dave Van Ronk that convinced you to move to New York City. Is that right?
It was, yeah. I met him in 1977 at the Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs. I was a waitress and a bread baker, and he was traveling through from Montreal, and Lena said, "Play him a song." So I played him a song, and he said, "You should come to New York." And I said, it was the same night that Don McLean's manager saw me play, and he said, gave me his card. And he said, "You know, you should learn how to play guitar better. And when you do, come to New York, and I can help you." So when Dave said, "Come to New York," I said, "Well, I will. But first I have to learn how to play guitar better." And he said, "I'm a teacher. I'll teach you." So I was like, okay, that's decision is made, and 2 weeks later I was living in New York.
So that was in the 80s, in the 70s? When was that?
In the 70s, 1977. I worked as a temp for 8 years in New York City. I never, you know, there's no dignity in starving, and I always tell musicians, never take handouts, never let people pay for this and that, because there's always a much steeper price to pay if you allow other people to take care of you and you, you know, just are being this artist, you know, this starving artist. There's no dignity in that because you'll end up paying one way or the other and it's going to be much worse. So I always worked. I always had jobs. And I quit my last day job in 1984 when I was at Bellevue Hospital. And I was making $25,000 a year. I had a month's paid vacation and health insurance and dental insurance. And my first year as a folk singer, I made $6,000 and had no insurance, but I was way happier.
Huh. Tell me about late 70s, early 80s folk scene in New York City. I'm thinking what? That would be Suzanne Vega. Who else was involved?
Oh, yeah. Suzanne Vega, Jack Hardy, John Gorka, Cliff Eberhart, Nancy Griffith. Then eventually Michelle Schacht was part of it, Tracy Chapman. So many people. Lyle Lovett. A lot of it had to do with the Fast Folk Musical magazine. And I worked as a production coordinator for the magazine. You know, we all worked for free, and it was very ambitious. It was Jack Hardy's project where we'd put out a magazine every month, and it would have about 16 or 18 songs on it, and the inside, and it was a vinyl record, and inside would be a you know, hand-printed magazine with all the lyrics and short bios on all the artists, and it was available for $2 an issue. Started in 1982. Suzanne Vega is on the very first one, so is Eric Frandsen, Frank Christian, the late Frank Christian, Dave Van Ronk, the late Dave Van Ronk is on it. And after about the first 8 or 10 issues, the question became that we had to raise the price of the issue because people thought a record for $2 with a magazine inside couldn't be good because it was only $2. So we raised it to $4. And then another year later, Jack Hardy thought, oh, you know what, people, we have artists who want to do covers now for the magazine, and people want to write for it, and it's costing more money to go in the recording studio. So maybe we should raise it above $4. And people were like, oh, no, we can't do that. Nobody will be able to afford it because we were all poor. And by the way, I'm poor again now. But the funny part was Jack Hardy did a survey when they mailed out the next issue of the magazine, when it was $4 an issue. They asked the people to fill out the survey and send it back. And it was a smack upside the head when they discovered that the average income back in 1984 of the person who was subscribing to Fast Folk, the average income was $75,000 a year. And we thought they couldn't afford more than $4 an issue.
Oh, wow. How about that? So you were misreading that audience.
The issue skyrocketed $10 an issue at some point. Huh. But the thing is, I work so hard on the ones that I produce because I feel this is a permanent record of what is going on here. And years later, the Smithsonian bought up the entire catalog. And it made me so glad that I took it so seriously because my name is on it. I can't remember how many I produced, maybe 3 or 4 issues where I made all the decisions on who got on it, and I never wanted to have even like a B+ song. I wanted every song to be A++. And now anybody can go to the Smithsonian Folkways and they can buy individual tracks. They don't even have to buy the whole issue, and you can do it all digitally. And it's really a great document for that early stretch of the 1980s of what was being done in folk music in New York, and then it branched to Boston, to Saratoga Springs, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. And it's stuff that by a lot of songwriters who never got well-known but were very good songwriters and have, like, one guy, Hugh Blumenfeld. He's now a doctor. He's, a pediatrician, and he's very well-respected and very popular with his patients in Connecticut. And he's one of the people who recorded a number of songs on Fast Folk. that were really wonderful songs, and I'm thrilled that his stuff is preserved that way.
Well, there must have been something going on there, and then because a lot of those names you just listed are still recording and touring.
Yeah, you know, it was really a great way to cut our teeth. And the guy, interestingly, Mark Dann was the engineer who engineered almost all of the Issues. And he engineered, he mixed, he mastered, he played on them. He happens to be a first-rate bass player and guitarist and keyboard player. And just last night, I got an email from a young artist. His name is Jeremy Aaron. And he's got a record. He's coming out in March, so like he's way ahead of the curve on this. And he asked me if I would listen to his record and maybe say something about it, so he could use a quote. And you know, who am I? But I thought, you know what, I'm going to do it. I went home after I was here at the nursing home, and I put on my headphones and I listened straight through to his record, and I loved it. It's called In the Magic Light. I think that's the name of the record. And I looked at the personnel on the record, and there it was. Mark Dann engineered, mixed it, and mastered the album, and played bass on it with a superb group of side musicians. And one of the things about Mark Dann, you know, way back, I recorded my first studio album in his fourth floor attic in Brooklyn in 1984, and we recorded the songs in the order that they were going to appear on the record to save time and money for editing. And a lot of people, including me, once we got record deals and we started touring and traveling and got more money for our budgets, we went and hired, you know, much more accomplished producers and spent a lot more money. And all these years later, it's very, very clear that Mark Dann is one of the best. We should never have left him because he's doing such tremendous work. And I still see him every time I'm in New York. He works very hard. But a lot of people think, you know, once you start making money, you have a career, you want to work with the big boys. And it takes, you know, you got to swallow your pride and go back and realize you were with one of the best to begin with, and you're also going to save money if you work with someone like him who's so good and so fast and so efficient and so inexpensive. So it's been, we're all on a learning curve.
Well, I checked out your discography, and I guess the latest album I could find was 2007. Could that be right? Have you?
No, I released one last year.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it's called Christine Lavin and Friends Live at McCabe's. And it was done at McCabe's Guitar Store in Santa Monica. And what happened is I had never played there. It's very hard to get. It's hard to get them on the phone. I don't know why. But I finally got a gig at McCabe's. And I have a friend named Hillary Rollins who lives in Santa Monica. And she's plugged into the music scene there. And she had all these friends, great songwriters. And she said, what do you think of the idea of letting them do a song and show? I said, sure. So I show up at McCabe's with six guests. Not guests to get in free, six guests to be in the show. And some, you know, one brought his own keyboard, and you know, everybody had their own guitars, and it's a small club, and it's a small stage. And the sound guy could not have been kinder. And he said, okay, we'll just set up more mics. And the last thing he told me, before we started the show, he goes, by the way, you know, we record every show, and I'll give you a copy of the recording after. So I said, shh, don't tell a soul. I don't want these guys to know. Uh-huh. Because I know how it makes me nervous, knowing that it's being taped. So nobody knew it was being taped except for me and the sound guy and the owner. And the show went so well that it was so much fun. We were all in the dressing room. We're all, you know, happy at the end. It went great. We're all happy. And I said, guess what, guys? I think we just made a live album. They were like, no, you're kidding. And they were so happy. And sure enough, it was very well recorded. And I saw them. I'll have them when I play there in Carbondale. And this way, I have seven songs on the record, but you get to hear six guests, five from Los Angeles, and one from London, a guy named Daniel Kaner, who who I think might be the best solo singer-songwriter working in the English-speaking world today.
Whoa.
So I really go out of my way to encourage people to get this record, not for my stuff, but to hear these other great people who I think are tremendous.
Is that album available on your website? How can people get that?
You know what? It's on CD Baby.
Oh, okay.
And it's at iTunes. iTunes, I think, is really the easiest. So to just, but I've made records. Before that, I made a record called Cold Pizza for Breakfast. And I have one called, I don't make this stuff up, I just make it rhyme. But that might be the one from 2007. I've been making records every couple of years.
Huh. But are you still servicing community radio with those? I'd be darned because, you know, I checked our library and the most recent I could find was 2007. The Happy Dance. Happy Dance of the Xenophobe.
Oh, Happy Dance of the Xenophobe. Did you see that xenophobe is the number one new word of this year?
Oh, I wonder why.
But it's so interesting because I used that word back in 9 years ago. Well, you know what? I use Hudson Harding. They're the ones who mailed out to the folk DJs.
Huh.
Do they service you?
Well, if they did, it didn't stay on our shelves, which, you know, sometimes happens at community
radio. Well, I
can
ask them. But you know what? I also learned something. Years ago when I produced a record called One Meatball, and it's all songs, 22 songs about food, and there's a cookbook with it. Pete Seeger's on it. Dave Van Ronk's on it. Tom Paxton. I really, really wanted it to get nominated for packaging because it's beautiful package. It's got a really coated, it's spiral bound and the spiral looks like pasta. And it's coated to resist kitchen stains. And I personally mailed them to all these DJs and also to the people at the Grammys so that it would be considered. And about 5 days later, suddenly, there were at least 25 copies for sale on Amazon, and they were, you know, considered used copies, and I was the only one who had copies, and I personally mailed them, and so I discovered that, gosh, a lot of stuff somehow must get ripped off from radio stations by unscrupulous, mean people who then, you know, so those songs never had a chance. And then I also found out that the Grammy people would decide who wins the packaging by looking at the pictures of the records of the CD on a screen. And the whole point was you could hold it in your hand and it would look like pasta. So, you know, you might have some little light-fingered person running through your station at night picking up things. But,
yes,
you know, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody, but after we talk, I'll send an email to Eric Balke at Hudson Harding and see if you're on his list. Because if you're not on the list, you should be.
Well, you've been popular for a long time. I mean, who can forget Sensitive New Age Guy, for God's sake? I mean,
yeah, we still do it, though. You know, I kind of keep updating the lyrics because, you know, things change.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of change, and you were talking about xenophobes, is there anything funny about Donald Trump? Is there anything that you could write about?
Well, you know what? I actually wrote a song early on because I thought it was hilarious. And now, of course, it's just really sad. But I have this idea. You know, he started this new thing with Twittering that, you know, that the millions of illegal aliens voted for Hillary, and that's why he didn't win the popular vote. That's ridiculous. It's just, and he, you know, he won't get intelligence briefings, but he'll retweet things by 16-year-old boys and conspiracy theorists. What I want to get from my computer, and what I think we should all get, it's got to be possible, a filter that if anything says Trump, or Trump, his real name, or even like T space, R space, U space, M, you know, anything, that it doesn't appear on your screen. Because he contradicts himself so constantly that it just becomes a huge distraction and a huge time waster. And so we shouldn't pay any attention to anything he says or does.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
but that's not going to happen, Christine, is it?
No, I want one for my computer.
Well, I'm thinking that comedians and folk singers are going to profit from a Donald Trump presidency.
Well, you know, I think it's going to be such a disastrous presidency. I mean, you know, this new guy, he's just hired a Hollywood guy who has no experience in government as his the treasurer. And he's hired this, you know, he's hiring, so far, all the women he's hired have one thing in common. They're good looking.
Yeah.
Is that a surprise? Nikki Haley, God bless her, from South Carolina, a lovely woman, a smart woman, zero experience in international affairs. So, yeah, let's put her in the U.N. Let's put her on a learning curve. You know, really, there you know that there's got to be other people who are more qualified for the job. Maybe not as pretty as she is, but I don't think looks should be part of it. And, I mean, I can feel my blood pressure rising now. Oops. Don't get me started.
All right. Well, let's go to another subject that may or may not raise your blood pressure. I know that in the past it might have, and that is relationships. You're known for the relationship song. And I'm wondering, as an older woman, if that still matters. Is that still something that you're writing about?
Oh, yeah. You know what? The love of my life, his name is Maury. In fact, the reason I spent so much time in Colorado is because he had a house in Aspen. And his next-door neighbor was Jack Nicholson. But, you know, that's no big deal in Aspen. He died in January 2013. And to this day, my most requested song is The Kind of Love You Never Recover From. And I wrote that about him, and I have not been able to sing it since he died. Uh-huh. But there is a song that I do, and it's written by Daniel Keener, who's on the McCabe's record. It's called Under the Table, and it's the story, true story, of his grandfather, Isaac. And you know what I can do? When I get home in a couple hours, I can email you the recording, an MP3, or I might even have a wave of it, of that song, from the latest record by Daniel.
I love that.
Under the Table, because I'm telling you, it has such an effect on audiences because it's about the unrequited longings of a grandfather. And because I am older, I'm 64, and a lot of people who come to the shows are in their 50s and 60s, and sometimes older and sometimes much younger. But that song, Under the Table, about Grandfather Isaac and this woman who was a friend of the family named Ray, it brings the audience to the still point where when the song is over, it's really hard to read the audience after that song because I know that it stirs up trouble. I got an email from a woman who said to me, who wrote to me, I hope I never have to hear that song about Grandfather Isaac and Aunt Ray again, because there was an Aunt Ray in our family, and it was not a pretty picture. Please never sing that song again.
Wow.
And I wrote back to her, and I said, I'm sorry that the song upset you, but I think that it's a beautiful, heartfelt, and a true story. And I think that as we get older, it's good for older people to know that there are songs that are written about things that they may have felt or thought but have never talked about. And I find it really interesting. Sometimes after I sing that song, I ask, are there any grandfathers in the house? And these hands will shoot up and I'll say, oh, Grandpa. You fascinate me. But then I see the grandmother sitting with them, and they're not so pleased about this. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
But believe me, and I have a new song I'll be doing because I'm going to be trying it out this weekend in Detroit. It's called RSVP NYC, and it's about being invited to a birthday party. I was invited to a birthday party a couple of weeks ago when I was in New York by this very successful Broadway composer. And he told me, he does it every year, you're going to love it. You have a great group of people. Gives me the name of the bar, come after 9 o'clock. So a week later is the party. And I forgot what time it started. But I knew a friend was going, so I texted her. I said, what time does that thing start? And she said, I hope. Nice to see you. Bye-bye. So I said, what time does the party start? And she said, we're texting. And she said, 6:30. You can't be late. I said, 6:30? I remember, he said, later, you could come by any time. There was no time restriction. She goes, no, it's got to be 6:30. So I went back to my emails, and sure enough, he said, come at 9. After 9, that's when it starts at the bar. And that's when I discovered there were two parties. It was a 6:30 sit-down dinner in a fancy restaurant, and then there was the 9 o'clock party afterwards for everybody, not just the special people who got the dinner. So guess what? I didn't go. Because it was like an A-list and a B-list.
Oh.
So I've written a song about it because, you know, I think that that's, again, something that we all go through.
Sure.
And, you know, at all different ages, here I am in my 60s having my nose out of joint because I realize I'm on this guy's B-list. But he's not going to be happy when he hears this song.
Oh.
And I'm sure someday he will.
Well, you know, that's in your job description, isn't it? Cause a little trouble, stir the pot a little bit.
That's right. Woody Guthrie himself said it. The job of the folk singer is to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable.
Exactly.
So I tell people, you know, I have a couple of gun songs people really, really hate. Oh, my God, the emails I get. And I write back to them. I tell them what Woody Guthrie said. I said, you know, I'm disturbing you, your comfortable life, and I'm just doing my job.
Well, I saw one of your new songs, Don't Take Anyone, Put Down the Gun. So you're writing about that. And I also noticed on the part of your website, which, by the way, ChristineLavin.com, under the, what is it, the stories button? Is it stories? I can't remember now. But somewhere on your website, I discovered that since the 19... When was it? I've got it written down here. Hold on a minute. Since 1968, 1 million Americans have been killed by guns.
Well, you know what? That was from a newspaper article that was written in 2007. So that was the statistic 9 years ago.
Whoa.
That from 1968, the year that Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated, more than 1 million Americans have been killed by guns. Murders, accidents, suicides, not in wars, just in domestic things. And that's just a shocking statistic.
Yes, it
and
is.
Way higher now.
What will audiences see at Steve's Guitars on Thursday?
Well, you know what? They're going to see a lot of funny stuff. But both Don White and I do some serious. And I think... It's almost like you have to. For me, as a performer, a real light bulb moment was when I saw Steve Goodman play. And he did this hilarious song about women who love men who love women who love men. Something like that. It was just very, very funny. People were just laughing and laughing. And then the next song he did was called My Old Man. Mm. And people were just weeping. Not crying. They were weeping.
Yeah.
And I was standing in the back of the room, it was a standing room only, and I thought, holy mother of God, he went from one extreme to the other. Somehow, it worked, and I didn't even know you were allowed to do that. And I realized it's important to do that in shows, because people can laugh and laugh, but you've got to give them a break. And how do you know something's really funny until you contrast it with something that's really sad? And life is full of, you know, all of these moments, these bits of hilarity and these heart-wrenching moments of grief. And it's all reflected in the music that's being written. It's not reflected in the music you hear mostly on the radio for pop radio. Or, you know, I mean, I used to subscribe to Billboard and all that. And it's like you look now at the top 10 songs, and they each have 10 writers on it, and there's no melody and there's no point of view. But it's just like jazz. There will always be a folk audience, always be people who want to hear the truth.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're about to enter this very strange era in our lives as Americans. You know, a lot of people think, and I think this too, I can't imagine Trump being president for more than a year.
Yeah.
I just can't see him getting through it.
Yeah.
I don't think he really wanted the job. I think he wanted to win. And, you know, he hates being a loser. But I don't think he ever imagined how much work it would be and how he can't delegate everything. And the fact that his wife and son are saying that they're going to stay in New York, which, you know, has people in Manhattan just tearing their hair out because there's this giant Trump Tower, which is now a huge target, calling it White House North, costs $1 million a day that we as taxpayers have to pay to protect that building too, because his family is staying in there. And I would just wish his wife and kid would get with the program and go move with them. So at least give New York back a little bit of their sanity.
So some old songs, some new songs, some happy songs, some sad songs, probably a few stories in there.
But also knitting before and napkin folding during intermission.
Okay.
And I know that there's somebody listening who is like a champion napkin folder, because somebody will always come who knows a million more folds than I do, and I love it, and I have them teach everybody something. So if you are a secret champion napkin folder, which I think could be an event in the Olympics, I'm not sure, but I'm hoping someday. Please come, and I have these beautiful damask napkins that we'll be using, the real nice ones. And it'll be very genteel and civilized, and your next dinner party will be elevated by the beautiful napkin folds that you will learn.
Well, Christine Lavin, you are still delightful, and that's a relief, because I wondered. But I shouldn't have wondered. I mean, it's obvious. It's great. I'm glad that you're doing it.
I went to charm school, Luke, so, you know.
Okay.
That's one of the things that I've learned. No, I did go to charm school, but unfortunately I didn't pass. Oh. I was not graduating.
Well, at least they didn't wrap your knuckles with a pencil.
No. That's not a good thing to do. So if you're a piano teacher, please put the pencil down, back away from the pencil. It's no way to get children interested in music. Believe me.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure, and a lot of people looking forward to seeing you next week.
Well, thank you.